welcoming back to our stage after too long an absence, Gene Carroll. So let's have a...
tell you something. I have a husband. I must tell you about my honeymoon with him because he is the sweetest guy. We had reserved a honeymoon suite in a very nice hotel. And right after the wedding, I went up and I got into it. You know, I went into my room. He was in his room. And I got into this negligee, beautiful chiffon. I wanted to look as pretty as I could possibly look. And I brushed my hair enough of mules on my feet. And I thought, well, better get in that room tonight unless you want to annul the marriage. So I started back in. And when I saw him, I stopped dead. He never looked more virile, more masculine in his life. Handsome, his hair was slicked down, he had a pipe in his mouth, a maroon smoking jacket on, bedroom slippers, and white silk pajamas. Oh, he looked so nice, I hated to wake him.
Good morning, and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Sean Levy, author of the new book, In on the Joke, The Original Queens of Stand-Up Comedy, which charts the rise of women comedians from Moms Mabley's start in black vaudeville in the 1920s to the breakthrough mainstream success of Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers in the latter half of the 20th century. As well as a number of very funny and talented women, some famous, some almost forgotten, in the years between. Sean's the author of 11 books, including Rat Pack Confidential, Paul Newman A Life, King of Comedy, The Life and Art of Jerry Lewis, The Castle on Sunset, and most recently, the poetry collection A Year in the Life of Death. He served as film critic of The Oregonian from 1997 to 2012 and KGW-TV from 2009 to 2016, a former senior editor of American Film and former associate editor at Box Office. Sean's work has appeared in the New York Times, the LA Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, The Guardian, Interview, Movie Line, and Sight and Sound, among others. In the words of comedian Margaret Cho, In on the Joke is a seminal work on the incredible journey of women in comedy, past and present, for all of us hope there will be many more of us in the future. Please join us for our conversation with Sean Levy, which is already in progress. Sean, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Now, Sean, your original proposal for the book was more of a general history of comedy and politics, I think from World War II to 1970 or so. How did that initial idea evolve into what we see now in On the Joke?
Yeah, the original proposal was called Wise Ass Nation, and it was about the transformation of comedy from the early 1950s to the present day, really, when, you know, the only comedy, the only political jokes in comedy would be about Dwight Eisenhower's golf game. And now today, you go and see a stand-up set and all it is politics. And in that proposal, there was mention that one of the chapters would deal with women's entry into the field of comedy, stand-up comedy. And that was the thing that interested my editor at Doubleday. So he counter-proposed, is there a book in there? And I said, yes, immediately. You know, I have that freelancer mentality. If it looks like protein, I'm going to eat it, and then I'll worry about digesting it later. And it turned into a very rewarding project to research and write.
And to read.
Oh, thank you.
And you mentioned that working title, Wise Ass Nation. I think at the Powell's event, you also mentioned a few other options, Spitfires.
Oh, no, there was this particular book had different titles over the years. Spitfires, my favorite.
The Real Mrs. Maisel?
The Real Mrs. Maisel's, and Why Isn't She Singing?
And that's because the early comics were also singers and told a few jokes between tunes, I guess.
But also because if a woman approached a microphone alone on a nightclub or a vaudeville stage, it was expected by the audience and by management and her fellow performers that she would sing. There were so few women who only told jokes, like only a handful. And they were singular, and they became known, and they were exceptions, and they were granted sort of special license until today, when there are so many women stand-ups, It's impossible to believe we're not in a golden age, except I believe that more are coming. So let's not anoint anyone just yet. I think the best is yet to come.
No, comedy has certainly taken off. Now, these are the pioneers of women in comedy that you write about, going from Moms Mabley, Minnie Pearl, Jean Carroll, through the 60s, like Phyllis Diller, Elaine May, Toadie Fields, and Joan Rivers, who had a very long career up until her death, I think, in the early 2000s.
Yeah, she was performing until the early 2010s. I think 2012 she died, maybe 2014. And she was performing the night before she went into the hospital.
And how did you select them? Because there were some that you left out here, and then there's some that kind of share a chapter, like the bawds, kind right. of the women comedians who worked blue, as they say.
You know, I tried to aim as much as possible at what we think of as stand-up comedy, a performer acting in one, as the parlance of showbiz has it. So they're playing in one, they're on their own, they're at a microphone, they're doing a routine largely of their writing, often built around a persona, but sometimes that persona is very permeable with who they are offstage. It's not a costume, but the early women did adopt costumes. And this excluded comedic actresses. So Lucille Ball, Carol Burnett, Mary Tyler Moore, Shirley MacLaine. These are brilliant performers. They often performed live. They were very, very funny and beloved, but they weren't stand-up comedians. And the one exception that I made,
and we'll talk about her, yes,
was Elaine May, who's a special case, as we'll learn.
And just an amazing section. I learned so much about her. I was a fan before. We'll talk a bit about her. But you mentioned that showbiz term, working in one, extremely vulnerable and brave thing to do. You're up there. And you actually say in the book's introduction, the stand-up rises and falls on his or her own strength or quality or lack thereof. A stand-up has to provide laughs from start to finish or die from lack of impetus. That's true, of course, for all standards, but what additional obstacles did you find that the early women comedians faced on and off the stage?
Well, you know, every comedian has the sort of hurdle to leap of make me laugh, keep me laughing, and build. It's not necessarily storytelling, although some comedians do that, but there's, you know, it's sort of like a jazz solo or an improvised dance, and it's meant to be interesting and funny from the beginning. But the women also face the obstacle of like, why isn't she singing? Why is I'm supposed to laugh at a woman? A woman is going to, you know, we think of what comedians do. Comedy, stand-up comedy comes from a culture of complaint, kvetching, carping, pointing at someone else and mocking them, so, you know, often mocking oneself. And these things were deemed, in the parlance of the day, we're talking about the 40s and 50s and you know, early 60s, unladylike. To stand there and complain about your home life, to complain about your husband, your children, your mother-in-law, the people who, you know, waited on you at a store, your fellow travel companions or people you met, you know, on the street in a day of life. We're used to men griping about these things in the culture, and that was quite acceptable, but women had that additional hurdle. A, you're not funny because you're a woman, and B, don't tell me you're going to insult the very things, you know, apple pie and you know, housework that you're supposed to do in our culture. So it really was, if all comedy is a challenge to the status quo, this was doubly or trebly so.
Of course, these are profiles in the book. The book runs about 300 plus pages. You've written much bigger books on just individual entertainers, a great biography, Paul Newman, one I loved, Jerry Lewis. You wrote a book on Robert De Niro, all of them running 500 plus pages. How did you go about distilling the lives of the women you write about in this book so you can get everything between these two covers?
Boy, it was really hard. And there are at least three women in this book that I could have written a whole book about. I could have written a whole book about Moms Mabley, Phyllis Diller, or Elaine May. Of them all, of the dozen or so women who received lengthy treatment in this book, only Joan Rivers has been written about in a full-length biography. Phyllis Diller and Joan did autobiographies. Minnie Pearl did an autobiography. The rest are kind of still terra incognita for biographers. These are the most complete lives they've been given. I'm very pleased to note that there are young women, happen to be young women who are writing them, works in progress about Elaine May and Jean Carroll. But for me, it was hard. It was hard to keep it tight. I cut 30,000 words from the first draft manuscript.
I was going to ask you, I think in the Powell's reading, you cut Anne Mira of Stiller and Mira, who also would have been an exception.
Cut her
like
way
Elaine
down.
May.
You know, there were at least, I think to begin with, there were 12 or 13 chapters. Currently, I think there are 8 or 9. And there was a woman named Hattie Knoll, who was a showbiz journeyman who did everything possible, journeywoman, I guess, and had a very brief career as a comedian. She had an entire chapter because her story was mind-blowing. There was a woman named Jory Remus, who belonged in part with the Bauds and in part with Phyllis Diller, who had a very brief heyday and was very chic and then never quite gathered a head of steam and kind of veered off into obscurity. There was Anne Mira. Stiller and Mira were one of the acts that inherited the mantle of Nichols and May when Nichols and May stopped performing together. So there were a few people who, in my original conception, merited full chapters. But when I submitted the manuscript, it was perhaps 30% longer than it is now. And my editor was like, we need to cut it. And that meant sacrificing, in addition to much stuff that interested me, you know, reducing women from full biographies to mentions or you know, brief biographies within someone else's biography.
Yeah, you certainly captured the essence. And in some cases, like some I'll talk about, Jean Carroll, Elaine May in particular, leave the reader wanting more. And in those two cases, there will be more.
As you say,
there's bios in the work for them. But still, you were able to get in some fascinating details from the time, from the very trivial, like the kind of hair pomade that Moms Mabley used in 1930s Harlem. It was Murray's Superior hair pomade. And then you explained the term working blue. I had no idea how it came about. I knew what it meant. And then, I think it was in the Phyllis Diller chapter, how Maya Angelou actually got her start as a cabaret dancer before she was Maya Angelou.
She was Rita Johnson.
So, I mean, it leaves me wanting to read more about these people, but still you got in all these fascinating details in addition, like I said, to doing such great profiles on the comedians. Now, I want to get into a few individuals.
Sure.
Rather than pick some of the more famous ones, and we mentioned some, Moms Mabley, Minnie Pearl, Phyllis Diller, of course, Joan Rivers. The first one I want to talk about was new to me, and apparently new to you too. You were asked in a recent Saturday Evening Post interview, the question was, which of these artists did you come upon in your research about whom you weren't familiar? And you said, Jean Carroll. I was stunned. My agent and I were talking about the book, and he said he could put me in contact with Jean Carroll's granddaughter. We're on the phone, and part of my brain is saying, who's that? And you said you Googled her during the call, and you were like, holy cow, the first woman stand-up. What made her the first stand-up, Sean, distinguished, say, from Moms Mabley's act, Minnie Pearl, who preceded her?
Moms and Minnie precede her by date, although they were all performing. I think Jean and Moms were the first ones on stage. But again, if we're going to define stand-up strictly as working in one in front of a microphone and telling jokes, Moms and Minnie predate Jean Carroll by only a couple of years. What's different about Jean is Moms, even in her 30s, took on the persona of a crabby old lady and dressed in, like, you know, raggedy house clothes and slippers, and sometimes performed in a rocking chair, even when she was a young woman. And Minnie Pearl was a college-educated woman who put on the character of a man-hungry rube and, you know, amplified her hillbilly. You know, she was from Tennessee, and she grew up around country people, but she was not herself one. So they had these personae. Jean Carroll, performing as early as the World War II, came out on stage in a gown, looking elegant, the way male comedians of the day wore tuxedos, And she did material about ordinary woman's life. She wasn't in a character. I mean, strictly speaking, Jean Carroll was a stage persona for Celine Seligman. And Jean Carroll was her adopted name, which she dropped after she left showbiz. She was still known by it, but she went by her married name, Jean Howe. And she was indistinguishable, other than gender, from the men who were doing stand-up. You know, her delivery, her subject matter. So yes, Moms and Minnie Pearl are before Jean Carroll, but in modern comedy, we don't see too many people do outright characters. You know, say like Emo Phillips or Carrot Top.
Right.
There are, you know, people doing all kinds of comedy, but they do it in their own skin. And Jean Carroll was the first woman to do stand-up comedy in her own skin who had any sort of professional impact.
Yeah, in fact, you mentioned in the book that the term stand-up comedy hadn't even been invented yet. When she started in the late 40s, they were called comic monologues at the time.
Right. You know, they were comedians or comediennes with the French female spelling, which I avoid entirely. And there were other little terms of art taken from operetta and soubrette, and they didn't know what to call these people, men or women. Variety invented the term stand up. So much of the language that we use to describe showbiz was coined in the pages of Variety, and it didn't enter most formal dictionaries until the early 1960s.
Oh, that I didn't realize.
Yeah.
So it was basically a term to describe something that had already happened for several decades.
Right.
Now, you had mentioned how funny Jean Carroll was, but also you say in the book, she was funny, she was attractive, she was elegant, she was hardworking, and she was even enmeshed in a juicy scandal and trial, but you say she never really achieved superstar status. Why didn't she reach that next level of celebrity and success?
You know, it's very hard to say. She was married to Buddy Howe, who ran one of the largest talent agencies in showbiz as an agent, and was dean of the Friars.
Which didn't allow women for a long time, but
it meant he had anyone's ear whom he wished to speak to. The Friars Club, you know, the sort of rumpus room for male comedians. And Jean got, you know, she was on the Ed Sullivan Show many times, but starting very early in the late 1940s, when it was a brand new program. She had her own sitcom in the early 1950s, where she broke the fourth wall and spoke directly to the camera and told jokes. She played the Copacabana and the Ritz and the Palace, the biggest places you could play as an entertainer. And she never quite took off. I think there was resistance at all to a woman telling jokes in this format. You know, we're talking, her career started in like the 1920s, and she was on her own from the 40s to the early 60s. And I think she grew tired of banging her head against the wall. She felt like she was alone. You know, showbiz was so balkanized at this time. Moms Mabley was working only in Black vaudeville and in places like the Apollo Theater, the Earl Theater, the Howard Theater, you know, Black theaters in Black neighborhoods in the big cities of the Northeast. Minnie Pearl was working only on Grand Ole Opry and on the State Fair circuit and what was known as hillbilly and then country venues. And Jean Carroll was working in nightclubs and the Borscht Belt and some of the sort of mainstream, quote unquote, showbiz venues. They might not have ever seen one another perform. Each of them would have thought, I am the only one doing this. Moms and Minnie were beloved in their communities. They weren't seen as party crashers, and they were unique, and they were treated as unique and special. Jean Carroll was trying to crash an all-male party. And the roster of male comedians in the quote unquote mainstream showbiz culture was much bigger, deeper, and more entrenched than it was in country or Black entertainment. So I think she was up against a much harder game, and she had a personal life. And you know, there was no precedent for what she did. She didn't have any peers that she knew of. And eventually it just wore her out. She didn't want to do it anymore. So she winds up all but quitting showbiz at a time when most of the women who are celebrated in this book are getting started.
Right. And she's one of the few that actually retires from showbiz. A lot of them almost die on stage. Women in the book. You're right. She wasn't even 50 yet. She retired October 1961, which is a shame because the timing there could have helped her. I mean, a lot of comedians were taking off in the early 60s. There were new clubs. And the next one, in fact, took advantage of that. Elaine May, next comedian I'd like to talk about. She's in a section you call The Perfectionist, which is basically describes her. She's still with us. She celebrated when you and I saw each other the other day. You said it was her birthday. Her 90th birthday, actually.
90th, God bless.
Yeah. Again, we mentioned that there was an exception made for Elaine May, who was not stand-up in the strictest sense because she teamed up with others, either improv groups or, of course, famously with Mike Nichols for Nichols and May. So why'd you make that exception for her? You mentioned that she was a major instigator of a revolution in comedy.
That's right. You know, in the late 1950s, mid to late 1950s, comedy underwent a change. It went from rat-a-tat one-liners, Bob Hope with his office full of writers, to people writing their own material and being a little more confessional, a little more psychological, a little more culturally aware, politically aware, much in the way that prior to the 1960s, singers did not write their own material. And then if you didn't write your own material, you were lesser. Comedy went through a similar shift. And central to that shift was the rise of improv / sketch comedy in Chicago in the mid to late 1950s. Elaine May briefly attended the University of Chicago, and among Chicago students and the people who lived in that neighborhood in Chicago were a bunch of sort of theatrical innovators. And they got the idea to found a troupe that would do improvisation on stage with a comic premise every night in a nightclub. They had access to a little theater, and they named themselves the Compass Theater because they were meant to point the way to True North. And it lasted for a few years under that name, and then they became Second City.
Yes.
We now know as one of the great birthplaces of comedy of the, you know, the 20th century. Scores of famous comedians, movie star level comedians, superstar level, came through Second City. But in that first troupe of Compass and Second City performers was Elaine May. And she was considered the best writer in the group, the best performer in the group. And when they sat down and said, okay, now that we've done this a few times, I wonder if we should codify what we're doing, what the rules, so to speak, would be of improv. Elaine May was at the Constitutional Convention, basically.
The Benjamin Franklin of comedy. Yes,
exactly.
Sketch comedy.
Also born in Philadelphia. And of improv. She's one of the founders. And you could pull any of the women in this book out of history, and history might more or less be the same. But if you take Elaine May's contributions out of the history of comedy, I don't think comedy today is the same. She invented something, she perfected something, and she got so good at it so fast that she got bored and walked away from it. You know, by all accounts, when Nichols and May were on stage, Elaine May was the mercurial one who could spin on a dime and change everything. And Mike Nichols, God bless him, was a born director. He was a very good performer, but his great, great talent was being next to this, you know, cyclone of creativity and comic energy, and being able to say, oh, it's headed that way. I'm going to say this and meet her at the pass, and we'll have a rounded skit. And he could direct himself and Elaine while on stage. And they both talked in early interviews when they were such a meteoric success about like having a wild look in their eyes and knowing, yes, we've got it, keep going. And so much comedy today begins as improv and sketch comedy. Rowan and Martin's Laughing, Saturday Night Live, SCTV, all the inheritors and children of those cultural institutions. And Elaine May and Nichols and May are the font of that. So can't do a book about women in comedy and skip her.
Yeah, when she walked away from the act, I think 1962 or so, it was very much unlike Jean Carroll, who you said was kind of banging her head against the wall. They were at the height of their fame. They were one of the biggest comedians in the country.
Yeah, they were selling out a Broadway theater every night doing two-person improv. No co-stars, no script. I mean, some of the stuff they did, there were bits that they returned to again and again, and they would vary them from night to night. But their encore every night they were on Broadway was to ask the audience for a subject matter, an author whose style they could imitate, and the last line that they would end the skit with. And you know, we've seen improv groups do this, college kids, and you go to a comedy club, you see things like this. Nichols and May more or less invented it and did it live on stage on Broadway for about 15 months, 60 years ago. Remarkable.
Pretty highbrow, too. You mentioned the critic, Edmund Wilson, literary critic in the book. After he met May for the first time and seen her perform, he wrote, "Elaine is perhaps something of a genius, and he's not in the minority there. She transforms herself so completely in her various roles that until I saw her off the stage, I had no real idea how she looked. And then when she met Mike Nichols at University of Chicago, they were introduced by Paul Sills, who I think was one of the founders of Compass Theater. And Sills said to Elaine, I want you to meet the only person at the University of Chicago who is as hostile as you." It seems like you've painted those two quotes paint a somewhat accurate picture of Elaine May on stage and off stage.
Oh yeah, she was a character. She walked around with a baby buggy with all her papers and drafts of sketches and cigarettes. She smoked little brown cigarillos. She lived on candy bars. She was in, when the Compass people would be writing, coming up with new ideas for sketches, she was the only woman at the table and she would constantly be proposing things and they were shooting her down and one of the fellows remembered. And then we would try her thing on stage and it would be the best thing in the show that night and it would become part of our running repertoire and we all took credit for it. And we, you know, being a bunch of stupid men. And later, as she became a playwright and film director and screenwriter, and she became notorious for a kind of perfectionism that I sincerely believe a man would have gotten away with.
Hey, Jerry Lewis did that, didn't he, in his movies? You know,
Jerry Lewis, Michael Cimino. She did
Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah. She did three films in the 1970s, A New Leaf, in which she co-starred with Walter Matthau, shot a lot of footage, and the cut that was released was not her preferred cut. The Heartbreak Kid, where she was a director for hire, and even though she did a lot of writing and work on it, it really was a Neil Simon script, but she did a brilliant job directing that. And then a few years later, Mikey and Nikki, a gangster movie starring Peter Falk and John Cassavetes, two improv actors, for which she shot more footage than was used to shoot Gone with the Wind. Two-man play basically set in a couple of rooms in a single night, and she spent more film stock on it than Vincent Fleming did shooting one of the biggest epics ever made. And then, you know, it was another 15 years or so before anyone hired her direct another movie, and that turned out to be Ishtar.
Ah, yes.
I will always fight for. I think it's a funny movie. I think it's a good movie, but it has this reputation. I dare anyone to sit and watch Ishtar and then watch, take your pick of Sylvester Stallone project. Fist over the top. The Expendables, what are these movies that he makes with all the other action stars? And for some reason, Elaine May's movie is considered the epitome of the Hollywood bomb. I submit that if Sidney Pollack or Alan Pakula or Arthur Hiller signed their name to the exact movie of Ishtar, it would not suffer the disapproval that it did. I think a woman going over budget on a comedy was just a great excuse to finally put the stake in her heart and drive her out of the business.
And you look at what her ex-partner, Mike Nichols, did. He got a big break, you mentioned in the book, directing the Neil Simon play Barefoot in the Park, right after Elaine May left the act. That was around 1962. Then, of course, became a huge success in theater and film direction. Catch 22, The Graduate, just amazing career. But Elaine May's was equally amazing, if not more so. And yet, I think people know the name Mike Nichols more than Elaine May these days.
Yeah, in fact, she was just given, you know, she was given an honorary, a Lifetime Achievement Oscar, but she was also given an award by Penn USA, the literary society. She was given the Mike Nichols Award.
That's a left-handed compliment. Yeah.
But, you know, in the first years after they split up, Mike Nichols went on to direct Barefoot in the Park, The Odd Couple, Love, Plaza Suite. He won something like three Tonys and an Oscar. His first two films as a director were Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate. And there was an article in Paris Match magazine calling him Monsieur Success. And that same year, an article appeared in Life magazine entitled Whatever Happened to Elaine May?
And she never went away. She was always working and creating.
And they stayed friendly, and she wrote scripts. You know, she was nominated for an Oscar for Heaven Can Wait, the Warren Beatty film. She was nominated for an Oscar for co-adapting The Birdcage, which was a Mike Nichols film. She worked on the script of Silkwood. She script doctored a lot of films. She stayed in the business. She wrote plays. She wrote TV and screen projects that never got realized. And then she and Nichols appeared as George and Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in the 80s in Connecticut. And critics were banned from those performances, and it never left Connecticut. And then she won a Tony just about 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, for her performance in Kenneth Lonergan's The Waverly Gallery. And do yourselves a favor and look up Elaine May's Tony acceptance speech. She's in her late 80s, and she's still sharp-witted and funny, and it's just the most charming speech.
Another connection, you mentioned Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. The movie starred, of course, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, that was directed by Mike Nichols. Richard Burton knew Elaine May. I have a quote from him. He said, "Elaine was too formidable, one of the most intelligent, beautiful, and witty women I had ever met. I hoped I would never see her again." And this is a guy that knew women. He married Elizabeth Taylor, who is also very talented, witty, and beautiful. So,
She was a pistol. You know, Nichols and May soon after their breakup, but still at the height of their fame, performed at the famous Madison Square Garden birthday for John F. Kennedy, where Marilyn Monroe sang Happy Birthday to You, the most erotic version of that song ever. And there's a photograph of Elaine with John Kennedy at the after party, and she's looking down as if embarrassed, and Kennedy is looming over her, sort of smiling slash leering, and there are a bunch of men in tuxedos, including Mike Nichols, sort of laughing. And there's a number of ways to read that photo. And one is that Elaine has just said something that no one else would have dared say to JFK. And she's gotten away with it, and she's looking down thinking, I hope he doesn't, you know, drop a hammer on me.
The FBI investigator.
Yeah, it's a terrific, terrific cultural moment. I'm so looking forward. There's a young woman named Carrie Couriger working on a biography of Elaine May. And that was the one, as I was writing, I was like, oh, and my next book will be a whole biography of Elaine May. And by the time I was done, I learned of this other one in progress. And I'm thrilled that someone is doing it.
You mentioned Grace Overbeek, who's a professor at Columbia. Actually, she specializes in comedic studies, and you used her dissertation as some source material.
That's right. She had access to a very lengthy interview with Jean Carroll that was recorded and transcribed for a documentary that has never appeared about Jean Carroll. And she's at work for a book. In fact, I literally spoke to her this morning. NYU Press, they have a series of books on Jewish American culture. And her biography of Jean Carroll will appear as part of that series. And she's got a 2-year-old at home, so I suspect it's not going to be delivered on time, but she will get it done. Her dissertation is, I've read many academic papers on the subjects I've written about, and it's very readable and enjoyable and filled with things. You know, she has much more room to really talk about the nooks and crannies of Gene's life and career.
Now, there's one more comedian in the book I'd like to ask you about, someone I grew up with, because she was everywhere on TV at the time, all the talk shows, and they had Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas, those guys aren't around anymore, Joey Bishop, of course, Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. She's not well known today, and I'm talking about Sophie Feldman, who you may know as Toadie Fields. I knew her as Toadie Fields. And you consider her one of the women pioneers in comedy, and you quote Joan Rivers saying that without Toadie, I, Joan, would not be around, Lily Tomlin wouldn't be around, Carol Burnett wouldn't be around. That's high praise. What did you find so groundbreaking about Toadie's work? What do you think Joan saw in it?
You know, Toadie appeared on stage as Toadie, and she's younger than Jean Carroll, so she didn't suffer the same lengthy string of snubs that Jean Carroll probably suffered. And Toadie started performing just out of high school. She grew up in Connecticut. She was performing in New England in nightclubs as a singer. And she was on the bill with a comedian who she thought was terrible, George Johnston. And they were backstage one night, and Toadie, who was this little 5'2" perhaps, and a round little woman, but brassy with a big voice, she said to him, "I'm funnier than you. In fact, I can do your routine and get more laughs than you." And he said, "Oh yeah, well, prove it." And she did. And they wound up being married, and he became her music director and straight man. But she created a comic persona based on her life, much more so than Jean Carroll even, because Toadie is, you know, Jean Carroll took the stage and you were like, well, here's an elegant woman who's going to tell jokes. Toadie Fields took the stage and you're like, who is this? What is she? She did not look like an entertainer. She was heavy set and short and glammed up, you know, brassy, glittery outfits, lots of jewelry, big wigs. And then she would sing songs and tell jokes about how sexy she was. And, you know, tease the audience about, oh, you're dying to get your hands on me, aren't you? And it was a whole, you know, it was kind of groundbreaking because women on stage, you know, other than the truly vampy women, did not talk about their own, themselves as sex objects. And here's Toadie Fields, who did not fit the contemporary ideal of a sex object, behaving like one. And that was the joke, but it was also her life. She used to say, "I have two kids at home and my husband smiles a lot, so I must be doing something right." And she built a career out of these pieces of herself in a way that feels very modern in comedy.
And she was much beloved. She was, in many respects, kind of the anti-Elaine May offstage, at least, where nobody said a cross word about Toadie Fields. Even the people she made fun of, like Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah, she talked about Elizabeth Taylor in a very charming way. She said, "We have the same measurements, Elizabeth Taylor and I. Her living room is 20x20, and so is mine." So she wasn't quite, they weren't quite digs. Elizabeth Taylor was just like the ideal that she used to compare herself to comically. But Toadie Fields was, you know, a hardworking, glad-handing. She was a family woman. She took her daughters and husband with her. She literally performed with her husband on stage as her music director. But her daughters, frequently in her early career, she would only take jobs that she could drive to so that she could be back while her daughters were growing up. And when, you know, her career became super big and she moved to the West Coast from New York City, she lived and worked mainly in Las Vegas and Los Angeles. So again, she could keep the household together. And that's another thing that these women had in common. Most of them were mothers, and most of them had to come up with some way to be a professional entertainer and a mother, a decision and a series of problems that no male entertainer ever had to face because they had a wife at home who would take care of the house and the kids. And many of these women were, quote unquote, homemakers in addition to being comedians, a choice that boggles my mind.
Now, Toadie, as you mentioned, she really never retired, but she went through a lot of difficulties. She had a kind of a botched cosmetic surgery where she had to get a leg amputated. She had two heart attacks, a mastectomy after breast cancer, along with diabetes, circulatory problems, and phlebitis. So she was really an inspiration, not just to other women comedians, but I find to anybody who's going through struggles in life, you probably don't have it as bad as she had it, and yet she kind of soldiered on. You write at the end of the section on Toadie Fields that she was unfairly forgotten. She would literally be reduced to a footnote in various histories of stand-up comedy, even histories of women in stand-up. Now, Sean, hopefully your book helps change that, but it brings up the question, why are some of these comedy pioneers forgotten, like Toadie Fields, maybe even a little Elaine May and certainly Jean Carroll, and some like Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers continue to get your recognition and celebrity, even though they're gone now, they're passed away, but their work lives on?
I think that Toadie, by really beating up on herself and her act, I mean, the idea that we should celebrate human bodies in all their various shapes, and human sexuality is not a laughing matter, but a point of joy and bliss, sort of makes her comedy look dated. Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers, their careers were so long. Toadie Fields died in her 40s, and really her career from fledgling to the moment of her death, and she performed almost to the very end, was barely 20 years. Mm-hmm. So in the longer careered women, there were changes. The early Phyllis Diller acting like the housewife from Mars versus the later Phyllis Diller who could make jokes about being old and having body parts replaced. And, you know, she doesn't go to the doctor anymore. She goes to Oil Can Henry's for a tuna. That sort of, you know, those punchy one-liners allowed her to adapt. Joan Rivers began as the screechy, needy single girl who couldn't get married, even though she had an annulled marriage in her past. Then when she became a wife and mother, she would make fun of herself as, you know, bad at sex and bad at mothering. And then as comedy coarsened and Joan's family, you know, daughter grew up and her husband died and she made jokes about his suicide, she became sort of like an insult comic. She evolved, and then she was best known for standing on the red carpet and making fun of celebrities' outfits at awards nights.
And for QVC, her own shopping channel.
She sold literally billions of dollars for merchandise, costume jewelry, and household items. She told jokes about the 9/11 widows not long after 9/11. She was a bold person, but that woman on stage physically did not resemble the young Joan because of all the plastic surgery, but also she adapted. She woke up every day and said, what's the new thing? What do I have to do to change? Toadie Fields never had that opportunity, and Jean Carroll wearied of the business before it got that way. Interestingly, Moms Mabley and Minnie Pearl were always Moms and Minnie. They didn't change, but their audiences wanted them just as they were. The wonderful story about Minnie Pearl, her real name was Sarah Colley, and then later Sarah Cannon. She's in a supermarket near her home in Nashville, and there's a woman looking at her. And finally, she comes over and says, oh, you're Minnie Pearl. I didn't recognize you because you weren't smiling. The idea that Minnie Pearl was seen as this character on whom the sun always shone was very precious to her audience. So even when she was a trooper and had been in the racket for 50 plus years, she was always the sweet, sunny girl from Grinder Switch, which is how her routine began.
Now, I singled out a few of the lesser known subjects in the book because I found those stories fascinating. And a lot of people like me don't know the backstory. Jean Carroll, Elaine May, Toadie Fields. But when you were working on an early version of the book, Sean, your editor suggested ending it with a section on Joan Rivers, which you do. You've referred to her as the Beatles of women's stand-ups. Why that comparison?
Well, Joan arrives sort of fully formed in one night on American television, February 1965, on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. She gets the final 10-minute slot. And overnight, she's a sensation and has a career, and that career lasts nearly 60 years. But she had been working to get to that slot for 10 or 12 years. And when she finally sat down on that Tonight Show couch, she had synthesized so much of what had come before her. Like Jean Carroll and Phyllis Diller, she did a rat-a-tat man-style one-liners set. Like the bawds, Sophie Tucker, Belle Barth, Pearl Williams, she worked a little on the risque side, talking about, you know, man problems, but maybe a little explicit, more explicitly than you would expect from a pretty young woman in a cocktail dress and pearls. And like Elaine May and the other comedians of her generation, mainly men, Lenny Bruce, Bill Cosby, Shelley Berman, she worked psychologically, revealing something about herself. So she synthesized all the things that women comedians before her had done in a very attractive, spry, modern package and had this overnight success. And the fact that the Beatles exist doesn't mean you can't enjoy Little Richard or Elvis Presley or the blues musicians who influenced them,
right.
But it's a new style conflation of everything that had preceded. And Joan Rivers was that to me. And I knew that from the moment the book was proposed, you know, counter-proposed to my Wise Ass Nation proposal. I was like, oh, this is a book that ends with Joan Rivers because she's the acme. She's where all these streams head. What surprised me, I didn't originally consider putting Moms Mabley and Minnie Pearl in the book, because I thought, well, they worked in narrow niches of showbiz. Then I realized, oh my God, that makes them all the more heroic, because there was no encouragement. And each of the women in the early years, Moms, Minnie, Jean Carroll, even Phyllis Diller, probably thought, I am the only one doing this. And the amount of courage and moxie and resilience and fortitude that it takes to work doing comedy with that mentality is just awe-inspiring.
And I think that's very clear from the book. You did a great job on that and kind of uncovered a shadowy part of American comedy history, or certainly one that hasn't been written about a lot. And hopefully you'll inspire other authors to do their own books. I just want to thank you, Sean, for the book, for talking with us today. I want to close with a quote from an interview, that Saturday Evening Post interview you did a few days ago. You said, the more time I spent with each and every one of these women, the more respect I had for them. You can never celebrate women who have been overlooked enough.
I'll co-sign that.
I'll ditto it. Ben Franklin, I think, would even sign that one.
No, okay. It was a joy to learn these stories and to share these stories. And I look forward to the day, you know, when I write a book, I'm always looking for a hole on the bookshelf that I can fill with a project of my own. And this book needed to be on the bookshelf to get these women onto paper. And if in 6, 8, 10 years, there's 5 books, one on, you know, each of one of the women in this volume, I will blurb them, I will tweet them, I will buy them, I will celebrate them. I think these women are heroes, and any young comedian or you know, anyone who likes comedy or just is interested in the struggle of women to gain equal opportunities in the workplace will find something in this.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, we'd like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it if we had a director. You could listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Sean Levy, author of the new book, In on the Joke, The Original Queens of Stand-Up Comedy. Sean will be appearing at Portland's Broadway Books on Wednesday, May 18th at 6:30 p.m. and Book Soup in West Hollywood on Tuesday, May 24th at 7 p.m. You can find out more about the new book and all of Sean's upcoming events on his website, Sean, S-H-A-W-N, Levy.com. Just a reminder that KBOO is in the middle of our spring drive. We're trying to raise $56,000 by May 28th, and we could use your help. KBOO is true listener-sponsored community radio. We get 80% of our funding from our members, listeners like you. You can support programs like this and independent media by becoming a member today. It's as simple as going to the KBOO website, kboo.org, and clicking on the big donate button. Or you can text KBOO to 44321. And if you donate now, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $12,000, thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Together, we can keep KABU going strong throughout 2022, which marks our 54th year on the airwaves, and hopefully many more years to come. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, May 12th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying...
Hello, Arthur. This is your mother. Do you remember me?